welcome to Season 7 of The Process Podcast, an interview series exploring the process of survival as a creative. For this season, we're going back to our roots and talking to all sorts of creatives from a wide variety of industries, backgrounds, and creative endeavors about how they make it all work, from mental health to relationships to money to the creative process itself, and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Shannon Byrne, and I'm just trying to figure it out like the rest of us. Big thanks to the band Blessed for letting us use our song Endure as our intro music for this season. You can find their music at Blessed, that's B-L-E-S-S-E-D, band.bandcamp.com, or wherever you buy your music. And to Hannah Spencer for all of the design and branding and the strategy work she does for us. And Lonnie Webb for running our social media. Thank you for listening. Hope y'all dig it. Hi, hello. Welcome to episode 85 of The Process Podcast. This episode is with artist Joni Sternbeck. Joni is known for her work in large format as well as her wet plate prints. She is a native New Yorker. She holds a BFA in photography from the School of Visual Arts and an MA from NYU International Center of Photography. She uses both large format films and early photographic processes to explore the present day landscape and to make environmental portraits. Her work centers on our relationship with water, contrasting some of the most desolate deserts in the American West to iconic surf beaches around the world. You can find her work in galleries and museums, and she has published several books. We talk a lot about her Surfland book and series in this episode, but other books include High Tide, Montauk Point, which is a limited edition handmade book that's also super beautiful, as well as Surfsite Tintite, The Passengers, which documents folks in 1970s New York subways. And Surfland, which we talk about here, is a project she worked on for 13 years, documenting surfers around the world using the wet plate process, which isn't the easiest to travel with. She literally sets up dark rooms like on the beach and has a huge heavy cameras that she takes, and everything is developed on the spot there on the beach. It's pretty awesome. You can find Joni's work in many public collections, with recent acquisitions from the Joslin Art Museum, Harn Museum, MoCA, and the National Portrait Gallery in London. She is the recipient of several grants and prizes, including the Cairns John Laughlin Award and the second prize winner in the Taylor Wessing Portrait Prize competition. In this episode, we talk about capturing emotional landscapes. She really dives into how the wet plate process works, like what it looks like, how she learned wet plate, her history, how she became a photographer, the importance of taking a chance and following spontaneity in order to gain a new perspective, the value of finding community as an artist, what can come from making books of your work, the impact it can have financially as well as making your work more accessible to more people, what feminism in art means to her, what she found among her observations of the surf community over the years, what photography culture was like in the 1970s, what it was like to bring a project to a close after 13 years, how she defined success, and what's next for Joni, and a whole lot more. I got to sit with Joni in her studio for this conversation, which was stunning in Gowanus. It was a perfect day over the summer. It was like 75 and sunny somehow. We had an early summer. It wasn't quite New York hot yet. And the light was perfect and her large format prints were up. I got to flip through her books. It was a real honor to be in her space and to see the tools that she works with in person and to see the products in person and touch them and hold them. So thank you to Joni for inviting me into your space and for this conversation. And thank you for being here and listening. I hope you dig it and I'll catch y'all next week. Cheers.
So I don't know a ton about like your background and history, which I'd love to get to at some point.
Okay.
But we can kind of like start in the middle, move around.
Okay.
As I was saying, I was really attracted to your work because I tend to be attracted to work that involves water. I did read on a couple bios that is very much a part of your work.
Yes.
Where does that come from?
Well, it's funny. I was interviewed in Australia for like their like public television program, and they asked me that very question. This is back in 2011. And for some reason, like, I just didn't have my answer down pat. So, like, I just thought back and it's from my grandmother from my childhood.
Okay.
And we spent a lot of time at the beach and at the ocean, mostly Rockaway, Long Beach.
Okay.
Later a little further out east in New York. But yeah, it comes from childhood and just this desire to be closer to the water.
Are you from New York?
Born in the Bronx.
Oh, wow. Have you been based here the whole time?
I've been based in New York for all my life, except for 1 year. We moved overseas to London and lived there for a year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What brought you to London?
Well, the main reason was we did not want to spend and raise our children here, like, without having done anything out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
And so I just felt like, are we going to spend our whole lives just living here? As though it were the most boring thing in the world.
Right.
But I just felt like we needed, I don't know where we came from when we grew up, and, you know, you challenged a lot of things. So with that challenge, we took ourselves over to London. My husband opened up a photo lab, and we sent our kids to school there. And yeah, we're still paying the price.
Yeah. And which way? There could be so many ways.
Well, having given it was harder for my son. He was 13. My daughter was just 6. So she was just going to first grade and learned how to read. So it was really fun. It was a really interesting year for all of us. And we all grew so much and came together as a family in a way being in New York would never have made you, you know, never would have brought a family together.
Yeah, right. Because you're like, everyone, even children, are so busy.
Yeah.
Like, have their schedules. And
right.
They're like,
and, you know, like, you just, you don't know people. You don't have friends. Mm-hmm. You are, it's just the four of you until you can sort of, you know, get a footing.
Right.
So it took like 6 months for that to happen. But.
And then you were like, this isn't for us. Let's go back home. Or?
No, we actually wanted to stay, but my husband's father was very sick. So okay. We came home for that.
Mm-hmm. And your husband's a photographer too?
Yeah.
Cool. I guess going way back, at what point did you pick up a camera?
So I went to art school, School of Visual Arts, and I was a fine arts major. Mm-hmm. And so as a fine arts major, they make you take a course in photography.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did, and I really liked the camera. I took one the first semester, I took one the second semester, and then I thought about transferring to the photography department. And, you know, this was like my second college also. So I was like already a little older than some people. And it just really clicked with me. And I, at some point between like their two buildings, between 21st Street and 23rd Street, I decided this is what I am going to be. And I am.
Yeah. Yes, you are. A great one.
No, thank you.
And yeah, from what it seems like a very established one too. So...
Well, I've been making pictures a very long time, but I'm not sure how exactly established I am because, you know, back when I began in the 1970s, the photography culture was more Robert Frank, mm-hmm. Diane Arbus, Gary Winogrand, Duane Michaels. Those were the people that were around them and the kinds of photographs that were being made. Lee Friedlander, there were the big names, and then there was nobody.
Yeah.
And then sometime, you know, in the 80s to the 90s, things shifted and the art world kind of cracked open with like the East Village and just all these alternative art neighborhoods and galleries opening up. And when that happened, you know, I started making my work that was about water and I kind of just got a little footing in. The art world is a funny little devil.
Yeah.
And it's forever changing. So anyway, it took really making this body of work to kind of get my name on the map.
You started doing this when?
I started the Surfland series in 2006.
Okay.
And I started making or learning about wet plate in 1999.
Okay, cool. What attracted you to wet plate?
I wasn't immediately, like, I didn't know about, actually, it's terrible that I didn't really know what I was doing because I went upstate to do a workshop in wet plate.
Mm.
And with this person named John Coffer, who I don't know if Carrie's ever talked about him, but he is quite a significant individual. He lives a 19th century life on a farm in upstate New York. And so when you go to his workshop, you walk onto his farm and he has a handmade log cabin and a porch.
Mm.
And he talks very slowly, uh-huh. And you sit on the porch and he shows you some 19th century manuals on the wet plate process. So you're immediately like elsewhere.
Yeah. Totally.
Then he starts talking about the process, and you know, when the process was original, in between, you know, it's heydays, in like 1850 to 1870. Mm-hmm. And so during the Civil War, it's just so weird to learn from somebody who lives that kind of life today, you know, built himself an outhouse, cooks his fire, you know, out on a campfire, and the whole workshop took place outdoors. So that's when I learned the process. And really, I didn't remember it from photo history. I didn't ever work with it or know anybody who had worked with it up until that point. Mm-hmm. I worked with other alternative processes like, and 19th century processes like cyanotype and platinum palladium and gum printing and calitype, but not that. What really attracted me to this process is that it's immediate. You coat the plate, you sensitize it, you take the picture all within a 10 to 15 minute period, and then you get a positive if you're making a tintype. And it's just a fabulous experience watching it emerge from the fixing bath and just seeing this image on a piece of tin that, you know, the day before you coated with black Japan and baked it in an oven.
It's like a good amount of science, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
A very good amount of science.
Yeah. It's very intimidating for someone like me who like has a hard time wrapping my head around like technical stuff.
Well, it's like, you know, it's like a hard recipe.
Yeah.
Where you have to send away for the ingredients and, you know, they could possibly kill you.
Right.
Think of it like that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Good point. You take a large camera out into the beach. Like, what made you decide that was going to work?
Well, I started out by making large format photographs of close-up details of the ocean surface, mm-hmm. like this, and that's like the smaller version over there.
Yeah.
And when I did this, I started this the same year that I learned the wet plate process, but I went out to Montauk and I started in the middle of winter and I set my camera up on a bluff high above the ocean, mm-hmm. you know, facing down into the water with a very narrow point of view so that you would not see the foreground, you wouldn't see the beach, and you wouldn't see the horizon. So just the ocean surface. Mm. And I did this because I was interested in creating what I thought of as an emotional landscape. And I thought the ocean was the place to do this.
Yeah.
That's how I started photographing the water. Mm. Then by springtime, it turned out that I just happened to be at a surf break, this very same spot that I would go to. Was a surf break called Poles. And, you know, when you're focusing in on a very narrow point in the ocean and there's somebody in your frame, it's quite remarkable. Like, mm-hmm. why are they here? Why are they in my picture? So I know how to whistle. So I put my two fingers in my mouth and I whistled and I motioned for them to get the hell out of my frame. So this was like the first contact. Mm-hmm. And so this originally was, you know, I had this opinion that surfers were intruders. Mm. You know, what are they doing in my landscape? Get out. And then later on, a few years later, I changed the frame of my photograph and I lifted it up towards to have a very little piece of the ocean, but and a lot of sky. And I got to the beach the day after it had been very stormy and positioned the camera eastward, so from the bluff. So there, it just happened to be one of those glassy, beautiful ocean days where there were 50 to 100 people in the water surfing.
Yeah.
And I didn't necessarily want to make a picture of surfers, but they were there and there was no whistling to get them out of the way.
Right.
And so at a certain point, though, the sun broke through the clouds and there was this like incredible hush at that moment, and then like a cheering that took place mm-hmm. just as I snapped the photograph. Mm-hmm. And this photograph turned out to be like a very successful photograph. And it made me feel like I had a connection with all those people in the water. Mm-hmm. So that was like the connector. And yeah. then when I learned wet plate, several years later, I went back to that very same bluff, like return to the scene of crime kind of thing.
Yeah.
And ran into somebody who agreed to pose for me with my camera and do the whole thing. He walked down to the beach. I snapped this photo, never saw the guy again. And I knew from this one photograph that surfers would make this excellent subject for a project with wet plate, because wet plate has a lot of like the chemical has a lot of sensitivities and insensitivities, but it also has elements about it that, like, it's really good at recording motion and time and water, but without something really solid as a main subject, it's less successful. So right before the surfer had showed up, I had taken a photograph with nobody in the water. And it's just this blurry, it's not totally blurry, but it's just this hazy, boring photograph of, you know, of the sand and the sky.
Yeah.
But with a person there, it anchored it on so many levels in terms of, you know, our relationship to the water, our relationship, people in the landscape, small people in a landscape. It just gave the photograph a deeper meaning and a better connection.
But yet you didn't feel that way when you were doing just taking film, large format,
right,
medium
because,
format.
You know, I think there's something to the tunnel vision mode of an artist. And when I'm working on a certain project, it's often very difficult to kind of come out of that and to use this idea of chance, accident, spontaneity as a reason to shift your point of view,
yeah,
at that moment. But that's exactly what I ended up doing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. And have you ever picked up surfing yourself?
I did have a few surf lessons over the 13-year course of this project.
Yeah.
One in Hawaii and one in Australia. Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm not a surfer, but I'm stand-up paddler and I'm an ocean lover.
This might seem like a silly question, but are the surfers like generally pretty friendly and open to you? I feel like I've heard that that culture can be a little bit like closed off to, yeah, and territorial for,
yes,
sure, especially if you're capturing like their favorite spots.
Well, I think that level of real estate, you know, hostility takes place more in the water than it does on the land.
Right.
So I was afraid that they, I don't know, I was very intimidated by surfers when I first went to the beach.
Totally.
And there weren't that many of them,
mm-hmm,
to even be intimidated by. But I don't know why I had that idea.
Yeah.
It was quite false. I found most of the surfers to be very friendly and really interested in being part of the project.
That's good. With time, it seems like you started getting to know them a little bit more, like,
right,
compared to the first guy who you took,
right,
the photo and never saw him again.
Right.
Did you start to learn more about their stories and ask them questions? Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, first what I did was I just basically set my camera up on the beach on a tripod, set up my dark box, and I just kind of waited for something to happen. Rather than kind of going out and forcing it,
mm-hmm,
I just waited for people to come to me. And a large format camera, you know, on a wooden tripod in the middle of the beach is a nice, you know, conversation piece.
Totally.
And so I talked a little bit about my project and I asked them if I could photograph them. And the good thing about, you know, going to the beach, you know, as a place to visit with the wet plate process is that there are so many people there. You can turn the camera in a variety of different directions and have several different photographs. Whereas if you're photographing a landscape with wet plate, you go to your choice of landscape, your whatever that may be, and you take your picture, and after one or two pictures, it's kind of done.
Yep.
Then you have to move on to another place. So this is a place you can go all day. There's a constantly changing scene, you know, and the dynamics of the beach, they're just always in, you know, they're always shifting and in motion.
Yeah.
So it's a very dynamic way to work, except you're working in public. And so that is a little nerve-wracking.
Totally. Yeah. Especially because it takes like 10 to 15 minutes, right?
Well, that's when you're all set up and you can knock them out.
Okay.
I can knock one out, one 8x10 every 10 to 15 minutes if I'm in the flow.
Wow. Wow. And how long does a person have to
stand
in front of the camera? Yeah.
I make them stand about 7 minutes. Like I make them stand long enough to frame the photograph, to coat the plate, and then to go back and shoot it.
Wow.
I used to make them in the beginning when I was less sure of what I was doing. I used to make them wait there while I went to process it in case, like, you know, I had to go back. But that was quite unnecessary.
Well, I get it though. This is getting a little bit in the weeds, but like for people, including myself, who don't know anything about tintype or... is it tintype? Is that the same thing as wet plate? Or are they,
yeah,
different?
So wet plate is the process, and
okay,
tintype is the substrate that you're making the photograph on.
Okay.
So with wet plate, you can make a glass plate negative, you could make an ambrotype, or you can make a tintype.
Okay. So what does it mean to cook the plate?
So it means that you pour collodion onto the plate. And collodion is a chemical that's made of gun cotton and ether. It has iodides and bromides to make it photosensitive. And it's mixed ahead of time. All of your, everything you do for wet plate has to be prepped in advance. So when you, by the time you go wherever you're going, you're all ready to go.
Yeah.
So you pour the collodion onto the plate so that it covers the plate.
Mm-hmm.
You let it tack up, and then you put it in a, you dip it in a bath of silver nitrate, and you let it sensitize for several minutes in mm-hmm. the dark. And then while it's wet, you put it in the back of the camera. You bring it to wherever the camera may be, in the water, wherever. You make your exposure, you go back to the dark box, you develop it, and then you can fix it in daylight.
Are you doing all of that on the spot?
All of that on the spot.
How you do you find complete darkness?
You bring a portable dark room with you.
Oh my gosh. What does your portable dark room look like?
Well, like, I have a few varieties. The smaller version is a box with a black curtain.
Okay.
I have a cooler full of chemicals. I sit on the cooler. Mm. The dark box sits on the table. And when I'm, you know, either taking the plate out of the silver bath and putting it in the camera back, or while I'm developing it, the black cloth is over my body. And I look like I'm about to prepare for a puppet show.
Yeah. That's amazing. I'd imagine that drawing a lot of attention.
Yes, it draws a lot of attention. And it's a little bit like a dog and pony show. It's a little, you know, there's a lot of conversation that takes place. There's a lot going on socially on the beach.
Do you find that like a certain type or types of people are the ones who approach you? Because I know like I would be so curious, but probably nervous to approach you and interrupt your work.
Well, I work with an assistant, so usually okay. the assistant is the first person that they greet.
Okay.
And usually when I'm in the dark box, I'm trying to concentrate, so I try not to like yell out. But I, you know, like lots of people have come by and asked tons of questions. There's not really a type. I think, right. you know, there's some of the questions are very humorous. You know, are you making cappuccino? You know, what time does the puppet show start?
Yep.
Are you testing the water? You know, whatever. It's just, you know, it's something that draws attention.
Yeah. I'd imagine it in itself could be like a social experiment.
Yes, absolutely.
Or study at least, yeah. Going back to the workshop, which again, jumping around a bit, what made you take it?
To be honest, my husband had a partner and they found out about it and my kids were in camp and it was something that I didn't have to plan and I just packed up, got in the car and went. I brought some of my negatives because we were going to be making some albumin prints as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I just went along with the crowd. One of those rare moments when, you know, I didn't have to pursue it.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. it just kind of came to me.
Cool. And you were already taking photos of water then, just not with the wet plate.
Right.
What were you taking photos before then? What
inspired you? Back in the 80s, when my son was born, he was premature, I started a series called Something Between the Two of Them. And I had made a series of color photographs of myself and my son and my husband. And it was this kind of humorous, wry take on motherhood, marriage, well, from a feminist perspective. And it was a narrative series, so it kind of told a story. And I did that for quite a number of years. And then I went to graduate school and learned some alternative processes and started making these silhouettes of women modeled after Maya Bridges' study of the human figure in motion. I don't know if you know this study. So in it, there are women that are featured like walking. They're all naked and they're all holding domestic objects, brooms, irons. It's quite humorous if you look at it today.
Mm.
When you look at the series on men, they're all holding an object associated with sportsmanship and masculinity.
Of course.
So it was a way to talk, to like have a feminist perspective on a body of work and a way to picture women naked, but you couldn't see them naked because it was subverted through the silhouette. Yeah, so like all of these ideas kind of played into the Surfland idea in that, you know, back with the silhouettes, I was interested in having a conversation with history. And, you know, Maya Bridges lived, he made wet plate pictures. You know, I wasn't really looking at that body of work at the time.
Mm.
This is the work he's most known for, his study of the human figure in motion, or actually the animal in motion.
Was photography always your main source of income, your like main gig?
Yeah, well, I teaching. Okay. So I went to grad school and then I began teaching. I never really worked as a commercial photographer. Mm-hmm. I've always worked in the fine art field. And I also had a little portrait business on the side with film, trying to make a living. So yeah, photography, it's always been photography.
Yeah, cool. You mentioned New York in the 70s and the bubbling up of alternative art communities. Any reflections on that? Like, if you were to explain what that time felt like, how would you explain it?
I would say that time felt raw and gritty. Mm. And it was a really exciting time because I was just learning photography. The whole art world was just beginning in Soho at that time. I didn't even know where Soho was or what Soho was. And it was really interesting watching all these galleries emerge, come and go, and, you know, and the whole art world blossom, you know, by the 80s, you know, it was really in full force in Soho.
Yeah.
So it was, but the 70s were, you know, they were a gritty time when New York was a tough place and there was a lot of interesting nightlife and people doing some crazy things.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone like me definitely romanticizes those times, just having read about them and even New York in like the 90s and stuff, and also being very into music and like punk and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah.
But I'm sure that it was a lot grosser.
It was like a lot harder, more dangerous.
Dangerous. Yeah. Unsafe. Like, yeah.
Now people ride the subways all hours of the night without fear of being, you know, raped or, you know, or mugged or anything.
Right.
Even accosted. Yeah. So it's quite miraculous. It's funny you should ask about New York in the 70s. I'm working on an artist book of just that.
Oh, cool. Rad. Like, it's of your own
of my work? Photographs, yeah. Oh. So I've been making artist books, and I've been going back into older work in my archive to kind of revisit the work and make a different kind of way of seeing it, rather than just pictures on a wall when you have a book and something you can open up. You can have a different experience with it.
Love an art book. Yeah. I was actually at the New York Art Book Fair earlier today.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Very overwhelming.
Oh, I went. I think I went on a Saturday last year, and I was like, I won't do that again.
Yeah, I went early too, and I was still like, all these people got off the subway at the same time as me. I'm like, ah, crap. It's already going to be very crowded.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was cool though. It's always fun to look through the books when you. Yeah. I picked up a friend's book I wasn't expecting to see because she's from the Bay Area. So
That's great.
Yeah. Has Surfland kind of provided this new opportunity for you to now show some of your older work? Has it provided, kind of put you, built awareness to?
Well, I think, you know, just kind of spending so many years in the art world and getting the work, your work well known or known to some degree, gives you some kind of, I don't know about cachet, but, you know, people do know about me and my work now. So I hope that creates more interest. I can't actually say for that though.
Yeah. Like, why do you think Surfland took off? Do you remember what, like, the initial?
I think that portraits of surfers, first of all, were something that really didn't exist in the photography / art world. Mm. I mean, there are tons of surf photographers making tons of surf photographs.
Like action stuff.
Yes, and exactly. That's the word action. So this is the exact opposite of what all of those photographers are doing. And so they're bringing a moment of pause and you know, stilled timelessness to the portrait. And I think also just my photographing people in the water, you know, like they're literally in the water. We're all in the water with the tripod and everything.
Oh, wow.
It makes for something, it makes for a different kind of photograph, somebody being still in the water. Mm. So, and also I think making a one-of-a-kind photograph is a very important element to this body of work.
Yeah, kind of related to waves. They're all one-of-a-kind, right? No two waves are the same.
Well, not just that. When you make a tintype, you're making a direct positive. So you are not making a negative. So there's just this one of a kind unless you choose to scan it and make a print of it.
Oh, wow.
So it's a one of a kind. It's a unique image.
Yeah.
And photography has always, the whole point of photography has been that you can make multiples. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of reversing that whole way of thinking about photography and making it a little more precious, rare, and unique.
Yeah. And meanwhile, surfing is such a ceremonial thing for so many people, right? Who surf, yes, too. And I imagine there's a good connection there. I was talking to someone recently for the podcast who's said how he went surfing that morning, and like it makes all the difference.
Yes.
We're talking about like how we balance and stuff. At what point did you get like a piece of press or something that like made it pick up, or did the surf community just start talking about it?
I had to earn my you know, creds with the surf community. I went back to the same beach year after year, mm-hmm, and I would bring people prints. I mean, I worked very hard to create a relationship with the community out in Montauk.
Yeah.
But early on, within like the first year and a half, I applied for, I guess it was a competition called Critical Mass. And basically what it is you pay some money to apply, and then you get into the top, whatever, 100 or 50, and then pay an additional amount, and then you get into the top 25, and then you the whole thing just keeps getting more and more narrowed down, and the winner gets a book. Mm. And I won.
Oh, wow.
So this was in 2008, and so I had a book published by 2009, and that really put the work on the map, and I had a solo museum show, which was like insane.
Wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. Which museum was that?
The Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, okay, Massachusetts.
Cool. Nice. At what point did you start bringing this out west? Because now you do both, right?
So right away, I started the project in 2006 in sort of like mid to late summer. And mm-hmm, I worked until November, and then it just got too cold. Yeah. You can't work in very cold weather. It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
So I decided to go out to California the following winter. And the surf scene is better in California in the winter. Mm-hmm. So I went up and down the coast in search of a swell, just like surfers.
Yeah, cool. And was there much of a difference between?
Yes.
How so?
Well, I didn't hear the word gnarly until I got out west. And and a lot of the surfers out west are way gnarlier.
Yeah. Fair.
I'll say that. And there's many more of them, and they were not so interested in what I was doing. You know, I just, if I went to a beach for a day, they didn't really care that much. It was winter. People weren't really out like summer,
yeah,
like here. And so it was a lot harder to get people interested. But as time went on and the internet kind of grew, there were ways of kind of putting a word out that I was going to be around. And then people would start signing up to come and have their photograph taken. And that became a very efficient way to work out west.
Okay, cool.
And then I began to meet people, and then over years I would, you know, meet up with them again. So I have photographs of some people, you know, from every year of the project, and some are just, I met them that one day and I made one picture of them. That's it.
Yeah. And I haven't flipped through the book yet, but do you tell their stories in the book too, or is it all?
No, not really.
Photos?
Not really. And this friend of mine said, you know, you photograph Joes and pros, but how come your pictures of Joes are better?
Yeah.
And I did try to work my way into photographing, you know, people who have really contributed to the sport, because it is this massive document on the sport, and it would sort of be negligent not to have, you know, pictures of well-known surfers in the book as well. So that was a harder nut to crack, because I'm not, you know, I'm just not in with those people. I don't know them that well. And I had to work it a little differently to photograph them.
Switching gears a bit, what are some of the challenges, if I'm assuming there are some, that you faced in navigating the art world?
I make large format pictures that are ultimately quite small.
Yeah.
And the art world likes large pieces.
Mm.
And the tintype process is somewhat dark, so I make small, dark pictures.
Okay.
That's a bit of a problem.
Okay.
Don't tell anyone.
Yeah. When it comes to, like, getting in galleries and stuff, is that what you mean?
Well, no, because I think the work really appeals to people, first of all, who love portraiture.
Yeah.
And who, you know, who just see this as this unique body of work.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, I've had a lot of success in showing with a variety of different galleries.
Yeah.
So that part has been pretty good. But in order to make bigger pictures, I had to get a bigger camera. Mm. So, you know, an 8x10 camera is quite large, but then I went to 14x17 and 16x20.
Right.
And those are big cameras to move about the beach.
Yeah. In terms of dealing with the business side of stuff, is there any like lessons or big takeaways that you'd share to people who are kind of coming up now?
Yeah, that's kind of a complicated, long and complicated question. Well, this process now has become quite popular.
Mm.
As opposed to when I first began, there were very few people in the photo world doing it, and there were very few places to kind of go to for advice and things like that. Now there's, you know, first of all, the, you know, like Facebook, Instagram, that whole thing has, like, I just got a message the other day. What kind of fixer do you use on the beach?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, I don't want to answer that question on the internet.
Right. Yeah. Do you find yourself wanting to keep some of that to your, like, some of the
process related? I don't mind sharing information. I just, some of the chemistry, like I said, is, you know, it's dangerous. So I don't really like to talk about it on the internet just because I feel like our political environment is not a particularly good one, and that I just wouldn't want to mention some of the chemicals we use on the internet.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. Did you have to figure all that stuff out yourself by trial and error?
There used to be this forum for photographers that worked with Wetplate. That's since kind of gone by the wayside. Other things have popped up. There are groups on Facebook, but there's also like a small contingent of people who make pictures that sort of are throwback to boudoir style pictures that I don't have much in common with that. And so I feel like with this process, people have gone back to take kind of a lot of the same bad pictures that were taken in the past.
Mm.
And feminism is an important thing to me. And these pictures kind of negate that whole movement. So there's a lot in this field that is murky.
What does feminism mean for you?
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's deep one.
Feminism in art is about showing women in ways in which women want to be shown, not in the ways in which men want to see women.
Yeah.
So it's very complicated. Like in art, it's always been men painting, photographing women naked. So now if you want to change the gaze, the focus, the intention, you have to do so in a way that's strong and that's to the point. Like that was the whole point of silhouetting a nude figure for me, that you would see the form and the shape and the beautiful silhouette, but you wouldn't be able to hone in on the details and kind of get that thing that I feel like nudity gives a viewer.
Right. Yeah. And you, for the Surfland work, it's a very, this might be ignorant to say, but it's like, it feels like a very male dominated sport. Of course, there are plenty of women and non-binary and people of all genders and identities who surf, but like has been your experience interacting with that aspect?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, the photography field has been dominated by men. The surf industry has been dominated by men. And there's kind of a similar parallel with how women are treated in both. Women were not getting paid the same for surfing in competitions that men were getting paid. And women were being encouraged to, and still I think are encouraged, younger women to wear skimpy bathing suits than to surf with these very sort of skimpy bathing suits that are very unsurf worthy,
right,
we should say. So there's this element that is also similar in photography, you know, which has also been dominated by men.
Yeah. Do you have any favorite photographers who really inspired you? Or even if they didn't, if you just like their work?
So when I first started this work, the people that really kind of set me on this path that inspired me were she's not a photographer, she's a painter and she makes drawings. Via Selmans is her name. And photographers Richard Misrak and Hiroshi Sugimoto are two of the people that I really admired. Back in the day in the 70s, Deanne Arbus, Robert Frank, those were the people that I was super inspired by.
Yeah, did you see the documentary on Robert Frank? That there was a screening, I think at Film Forum.
No.
it was made a while back, but like recently released. What really struck me is that he hadn't, I know he just passed away, but he hadn't created work in forever. And still was just like, totally, I mean, he's Robert Frank. Yeah. And he's like was able to live off that and be Robert Frank forever. And he was like pretty upfront about it. Meanwhile, like his partner constantly making work. Is that something you've found a lot when it comes to some of those folks who like came up in the 70s or?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I went to see the Gary Winogrand show at the Brooklyn Museum the other day, and I didn't realize he died in his 50s. That's like super young.
Yeah.
But you know, he couldn't, he like regurgitated work. Like he didn't even process his film. He didn't even have a chance to even see it all. It was all about the taking and the making.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Dan Alvarez died very young. And so it's interesting. But I think that, I don't know, some people say, like, do you plan on retiring? I said, artists don't retire.
Yeah.
They just continue to make their work. So will I make work at the same level and, you know, with the same brawn that I made this work? I don't think so. This work required working out and to lifting all that weight and carrying all that equipment and all those chemicals. It required something of great physical strength that, you know, I'm not quite so hepped up on doing today. Mm.
Yeah. Are you still working on the Surf Limb series?
I've kind of brought it to a close.
Okay.
Yeah. And I have some new projects I'm working on now.
Cool. Which I'd love to ask you about, but what did it feel like bringing it to a close after, you said 13 years?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It felt really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, really good, because I had started the project very locally in Montauk. Mm-hmm. Then I had taken it to the other coast, to the West Coast, you know, which is kind of where everybody thinks surfing kind of started. Then I went to Australia and then to England and France and Uruguay. And then eventually I made it to Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And I felt like once I made it to Hawaii, the birthplace of surfing, that I could kind of lay down my metal plate and say I'm done. It doesn't mean I have to, I could never do it again, but it's just, I think I've said what I needed to say, and that the process is, you know, has grown so much along with my project. So I've been able to go overseas and get the chemistry there. Go to Hawaii, get the chemistry there. You know, if I had done that when I just started the project 13 years ago, it would have been much more difficult and much more expensive to do it.
Yeah. So this project had a very, like, had a geographic end that made sense. But with other projects and stuff, do you find that the ending point just kind of, like, comes naturally? You just know it when it comes? Or do you start a project with an end in mind?
I don't start a project with an end in mind usually, but certain projects, you know, have a sort of a finite element to them, in that there's this thing that drives you when you first begin something and that you're super excited about, and it propels you forward. And I mean, it propelled me for 13 years traveling all over the place. I never went on a vacation. I only traveled to shoot, and it's a compelling thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can relate.
Well, now I'm going
vacation
to go on a vacation.
Yeah, that's right.
Actually, on Monday. But like, I'm working on something new that, like, I definitely see has a finite quality to it, and it's quite appealing,
right?
Because this was the kind of thing I used to call it an ongoing project, and I never sort of ever thought to give it a closing date. But I just, you know, I've got hundreds of tintypes of surfers, and you know, at a certain point.
Yeah, totally. Can you talk about your current and future projects?
Yeah, so I basically, when I first started making these photographs of the ocean, I evolved to making tintypes of surfers. And this project is, you know, and kind of an organic outgrowth of this, of the Surfland project. And I started to make large format 11x14 glass negatives of surfboards.
Wow.
So just paring down the elements and kind of creating a typology of surfboards, of historic surfboards, mm-hmm. that talk about the sport, that talk about the people in the sport who rode the boards, who shaped the boards. And with these glass negatives, I can make prints. And so I have a history of being a darkroom printer. And so it kind of puts me back in the darkroom, and it's a really nice change. Nice, you know, a big enough change to do something different, but it's also staying with the same photographic process. So,
yeah. I was going to ask you if wet plate tintype is your like favorite type format, or if you have a favorite format there.
Well, I think it's easy when you learn this process to think that that's what you should do everything in.
Mm.
And I did feel that way for a while, but I don't anymore. I just feel that the wet plate process is quite good for this project because it has a way of, it has color sensitivities and insensitivities that I mentioned before. And one of the sensitivities, it's very sensitive to blue and it's very insensitive to yellow. So if the surfboard has blue or yellow in it, it'll look completely different than in the print than it does in real life. And the other thing that it does is that because of these sensitivities, it can show things beneath the surface that you can't actually see with the naked eye. So you feel that you're, at least I feel that I'm getting more in this photograph of a surfboard than I would with film. I'm seeing it kind of into the wood of a wooden surfboard. And to me, that's one of the elements that makes me think of the relationship of the board to the writer and, you know, the photographer to the board and the surfer. It just connects us all in a very immediate way for me.
Yeah. Are you doing the same thing where you're setting up portable dark rooms?
Well, I have to bring my portable dark room wherever I go. This one is not a box. It's a tent because I'm working with a larger format camera.
Yeah.
But the photographs that I'm making right now, I'm making in a museum setting. So they're very out of time and place. They're not shot in the field on the beach. And that, so it gives them more of an archaic and archaeological element.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So people are bringing their surfboards to you?
No, right now I'm photographing in a museum, in a surf museum.
Oh, in a surf museum. Cool. Where is that?
In California.
Oh.
In Orange County.
Oh, sweet. Yeah. Thanks. That's fun. So is it like a collaboration with them?
Or? Yeah, they're super kind to let me come. And I it's something where I, you know, I've had a relationship with them for a long time. But still, they're a nonprofit. They're struggling to, you know, make ends meet there. So I'm hoping to do something to help them along the way, have them sell prints. I don't know. We haven't figured it out yet, but I'm there to assist them since they're assisting me.
Yeah, totally. Do you do a lot of like surf-related research? Do you watch a lot of films or read a lot about the culture?
I do read some. I wouldn't say a lot. I do have my little surf library over there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do read some, but there's a lot of things I like to read, so.
Yeah.
It's great to watch surf movies. Do you watch them?
I do. I don't want to project too much of my own interest onto you or my, like, I don't know, weird obsessions, but surf culture has always fascinated me, and I've always really loved the films, especially the older ones, how beautiful they are, like Endless Summer. And,
yes.
And the lesser known ones I'll never remember the name of, but, and the photos and the books and stuff have always fascinated me in general, the culture, so. But I do not surf. So I almost feel like I'm not.
Have you had a lesson?
No. I can barely like walk straight. So I run and stuff. But yeah, maybe one day when I feel like I have better core strength, I'll give it a try. Definitely a little scared.
Yeah. Which, well, it's a little scary.
Yeah. Mostly just like hurting myself. I'm not scared of the water at all.
Oh.
Or of like sharks or anything. Like all that stuff. I'm completely comfortable in the water.
Well, that's 90%.
No, I'm just scared of hurting myself with the board. Cool. One other question before I ask you the questions I ask everyone. This show is very much about kind of getting a better understanding of the economics and like building a business in the arts. And if you're uncomfortable with us at all, we can cut it out. But you mentioned like it's hella costly to like take all of your equipment to all these different places. And which ways have you been able to fund your work?
So my work is entirely self-funded, and I sell my work to museums, in galleries, and that's how I fund my projects. I did a Kickstarter for a book for my last book, but all it did was allow me to kind of pre-sell my book and to find my audience without having to do it from like my own website and create kind of a little bit of a marketing thing around the book.
Right.
But it's not like I have others, like I I apply for grants, I do things like that. That has, I have had some grants that have helped fund my projects. I should not neglect to say one from the Santo Foundation and one from the New Orleans Photo Alliance.
Okay. Cool.
So I received 2 grants for that, no bigger grants. So that's the way it's been from the beginning. The bad thing is that there's not a lot of support. The good thing is I do what I want to do.
Yeah.
And nobody tells me what to do. So.
Yeah, totally. Did you have a connection to New Orleans, or was it just you found a grant that fit here?
Yeah, it was the Clarence John Loughlin Award, and you send in an application. I had to send my original plates to this particular judge to have him view it. He wanted to view original prints.
Wow.
So it was like, okay, these are like my best plates, and I'm going to FedEx them all.
Yeah.
To the Midwest? I don't know. I'm very nervous about that. But I got the grant, so it was really worth it.
Yeah, totally.
The plates were not lost.
Cool. Any words of wisdom? I know we've already touched on some of this already, but words of wisdom to artists trying to get their art out there, I guess.
Well, it's funny. I was reading the other day, I can't remember who said this, but somebody very important, they were talking about talent versus tenaciousness.
Mm.
And talent is a wonderful thing to have. But a lot of young people might wonder, do I have talent? Mm-hmm. And that might be the biggest question. And really the biggest question is, can you persevere as an artist? Can you take those hard knocks? Can you grow a thicker skin?
Yeah.
And can you stay with it? Because that is what it takes to make it. And by making it, I don't necessarily mean financial success. A lot of art is not acknowledged. And as an artist, you have to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
So I think it's really good to find a community of like-minded people where you can share your work and feel that it has worth and value, because anybody who is unto themselves making things and wants to share it, I think they have a pretty good beginning. So those are my words of wisdom for today, and hang in there and just keep on doing it and prove those fuckers wrong.
Yeah. Love it. What's been your community? Where?
Well, back in the 70s, the community was the school I went to. Then, post that, the community narrowed down. Then graduate school, there was that community. Now, it's really changed with the internet. You can have a community on the internet of like-minded people, or just see other people's work that you would never have seen before in a million years. Like, unless so-and-so had a show at a very well-known gallery, you would never see their work.
Right.
And so it's wonderful. I'm an advisory board member at the Penumbra Foundation, which is a photography organization in Manhattan.
Mm.
And I helped, as like a founding teacher, faculty member there with my husband. And it's a nonprofit where they offer artists in residences to international and local artists and give them a stipend. There are dark rooms and workshops. So it's a small community that pulls people together through similar tastes and interests.
Totally. Cool. How do you define success? What does success look like?
Well, the best kind of success is the kind of success where you can sell your work and fund your work and support yourself.
Mm.
But that is maybe the hardest one to achieve on a steady basis.
Yeah.
There's the success where you're very well thought of, but if you didn't have that teaching job, you could not make a living through your photography.
Right.
So there's all different kinds of ways of doing things. I think making these small books is another way to kind of help income and just kind of help get your work out in the world in a much more a little more rarefied and also a little more accessible.
Mm.
Because if you make these small books that are, not a fortune, people in the book industry, will have an opportunity to see it and see new ideas that you're working on in book format.
Yeah.
As opposed to, a commercially published book.
Right.
Which is a great thing, and that helped put my work on the map.
Totally. What does the word process mean to you?
Wow, it means so many things.
I know. I love this question for you. I have thought about retiring it, but I'm like, I have to ask you.
So process means journey.
Mm.
It means the path that you take with your material.
Yeah. last question, which I've been known to lie about that. So it depends on what your response is. Theoretically, last question. What's something you're excited about today?
I'm excited about all of those young people gathering together to protest the climate situation in the world and to work for climate change. Really excited about that because I have children and I'm worried for them and their children.
Scary.
Yeah.
That's scary. Yeah. Cool. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.